This is 1360 AM.
WNJC. Washington Township. Philadelphia. Philadelphia's Renaissance Radio Station. Brought to you from Forsyth Broadcasting. Or listen to us at WNJCRadio.com.
All right, welcome. This is your host, Will Hemingway, and you are listening to the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. No tinfoil hats here, no ranting rhetoric, simple, stoic, thoughtful enlightenment on training in risk management, preparedness, and proactive survival. Survival is every day, so live well. The Practice Preparedness Radio Show comes to you live every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time on WNJC 1360 AM, South Jersey, Philadelphia. As always, listen to us live on the internet via my website, practicepreparedness.com. We stream every time on TuneIn. Find a link on our website via the Listen Live button, or if you are in the Delaware Valley, you can listen live at 1360 on your AM radio. As always, you can stream the past shows. You will find them archived on the website under show notes or select one from the scrolling list on the website's right column. Thanks for joining us. I am your host, Will Hemingway. I want to stimulate your little gray cells. Let's get started.
Let's get started.
All right. Good evening and welcome. I am, as you know, your host, Will Hemingway, and I'm really excited because today I'm going to have the honor in a few minutes, hopefully if everything works out, to have Dr. Peter Pry, his full name Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, and Director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards, and he has served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the U.S. House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He's an author of the books Blackout Wars, Apocalypse Unknown, and Electric Armageddon. I know he can call in, so hopefully we'll get him in a couple minutes. He called in. We were planning on right on the 6 o'clock hour. He's under demand. So before he gets to us, let me just tell you a little bit that we are really going to be graced by the opportunity for you to hear him speak in person on the air with us. He has spent a lot of time recently on one of my favorite TV shows on Fox Business, Lou Dobbs, and been on the radio with him. For anybody who knows anything about EMP, the vulnerabilities of the power system, and anything to do with anything in that matter, or who has listened to me at all on the radio for the last, I can't think of how many years, he is the quintessential expert at this subject matter. And I would refer you, I will put a link, I think actually I already have it up on the site, to one of his research papers, which is entitled The Long Sunday, and it's wrapped around Election Day 2016 to Inauguration Day 2017. And he begins in his introduction by saying, "May you live in interesting times." It's allegedly an ancient Chinese curse that certainly describes our own troubled era, when the world is on the brink of all matter of catastrophes, including the possibility of another world war. His think piece that is included in this paper, The Long Sunday, does not predict that nuclear electromagnetic pulse, EMP, attack is likely to occur, between the national election in on last November 8th and the 20th of January, but as he put it, was a sign of just how deeply troubled and unpredictable the times are which we now live in, when almost every day brings another unpleasant surprise that any or all of the scenarios that his report describes, they are entirely plausible. So I believe we have Dr. Pry on the phone. A rough week and a busy schedule, so we really appreciate you coming on to spend some time with us.
Well, I hope I'm not late. As I recall, you started calling at 6:10 or so.
Yep.
So I thank you for giving me a little time.
No problem.
An emergency off my desk.
No problem. I was just kind of buying some time and leading in by stealing some prose from you from your opening introduction in The Long Sunday.
Oh, yes.
So I basically read them the first two paragraphs of your introduction to give them a little taste of what was coming when you came on.
And that book is a cutting edge piece of analysis, especially for the unclassified world. It's the first time. It makes a number of firsts, actually, that little book. I'm very proud of it, even though it's probably the least known of my books. But it basically goes through and lays out nuclear EMP attack scenarios that could actually happen, that are not some remote theoretical possibility in the far future, but that if you look at the world from the point of view of Iran or Pakistan or North Korea or Russia or China, there are things that they might decide to do tomorrow based on their geostrategic interests. And so that's one thing. So it's the first time analysis actually shows for all the operational theaters in real time, the times in which we currently exist, you know, how a nuclear EMP war might actually happen in the near term, and what would motivate these countries, what would their geostrategic interests be, how does EMP advance those interests. It's a method. The other thing that's unique about it, and I'm particularly proud about it, is that it's kind of a handbook to explain. Well, there's three things. The second point is that it's kind of a handbook to explain to even military buffs and military amateurs, people who are interested, or professional people in academia or elsewhere, who are interested in matters military and strategic. You know, how do you calculate? How would you actually plan an EMP attack? It gives you basic tools for doing that so that you can basically do what the North Korean or Russian general staff would do, you know, showing you how to calculate the size of an EMP field and how you might actually lay it down to advance your military and geostrategic interests. And the third thing that I'm particularly pleased with this, and it may seem obscure to your audience for people who haven't spent a life working in military and nuclear strategy, but it introduces a new, it has maps in it or models in it that shows not just the EMP fields, but it estimates what the blackout zones outside the fields would look like, because it's more complicated than just putting the field down on the map and then assuming, well, everything within that EMP field is at risk. Because what will happen, you need to know the layout of the electric grids that the fields are laying over. Usually, in many cases, especially when you're dealing with other countries where the EMP field might be deliberately put down at a lower altitude so that the field is smaller, the grid is going to go outside the field. But the stuff outside the field is not safe. You know, the EMP is going to follow that electric grid, and wherever that electric grid goes, it's likely to be a blackout zone, a permanent blackout zone. So the actual lethal area is bigger than the EMP field itself. And this shows the combination. I think it's the first time that somebody has actually put electric grids into the maps, you know, where we've thought of the electric grids as a military target. and what the consequences of that blackout would be. I hoped that the book would be adopted to remove some of the mystery about EMP from people who like to think about matters strategic, so they could learn to do it themselves. A lot of times, I think the resistance to taking EMP seriously is the mystery surrounding it. You know, the people don't get it, they don't know how to think about it, but if you can calculate it and you can see how the bad guys plan to use it, you know, I think not only is it more persuasive to people that it's something we need to take seriously, but it takes some of the fear out of it so that we can more rationally approach this and say, you know, that makes sense, and we ought to be doing what the EMP Commission recommends, because I can do the calculation myself right here and see that that is going to be out there.
A couple of the things that you touched on are ones that my listeners and my students, when I give classes, have heard me touting for well over 15 years. The fact of the matter is that when you are incapable of fathoming the threat, like people were about nuclear weapons until they were shown pictures from Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and suddenly everyone had an extreme opposite pendulum effect. They really couldn't put their finger on it. So when people told them to hide under desks, which was kind of silly because the likelihood of it helping that much. Although I've interviewed a gentleman who was in his 90s who lived in within a few thousand meters of ground zero in Hiroshima, and he was a young boy. He got crushed under a 4x8 piece of plywood and lived in 90, so it's hard to tell. And that's really important. I have a link up of the YouTube video of you that's entitled Insights into the Vulnerability of the Power System, because you're basically preaching to the choir with me on that, hitting every point that I think was important. I'm a big fan, and I tell people all the time about you. I also am a big fan of studying history, and Sun Tzu and Napoleon's maximums of war, and you really hit it well, and I wanted to kind of draw you in momentarily, at least, onto that topic, which was in that video you touched on how over the centuries how Rome fell by them attacking the infrastructure, even though they were weaker, even though the enemy had basically nothing that the advanced culture did, and they brought them to their knees by destroying and attacking their infrastructure when they ignored them because they did not see them as an existential threat.
Yes, I see many parallels between the Roman theory, which is what most people go into, you know, which have pie-in-the-sky notions about how the relations between states can be managed through international law and arms control agreements, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, good luck. And economic sanctions, right? Yeah.
There's nothing more sobering and realistic, you know, and that makes a person cautious about the value of reasoning with others, okay? I'm not saying one shouldn't attempt it. Mm. But one needs to be realistic about its limitations, and only being well-grounded in history, you know, I think, can really convince a person, show a person, you know, provide them the grounding for making prudent decisions about how we should protect ourselves, you know, how much to trust negotiation, especially against certain kinds of actors, such as we face in the world today, versus preparedness, and how often war can happen at the most unexpected times, and it usually does. Usually history surprises us all. Even those of us well grounded in history, and just when all of the wise elites and all the wise men think we're safe, suddenly war's upon us, and that's the way it happened in World War I and World War II. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the Western elites prior to those wars didn't think they would happen, and it took them by surprise. And the Western democracies were almost defeated by the Nazis during World War II. And we, by Imperial Japan, because of that surprise, a shock in this new way of warfare that was developed both by Japan, the idea of aircraft carriers becoming the dominant force in battle. U.S. Navy didn't believe that before World War II, and the Nazi Blitzkrieg strategy. And the shock, not just of the war happening, but of this new technology that we didn't comprehend, you know, was so paralyzing and led to so many bad decisions on our sides that it was only through the grace of God, really, and the blood of 30 million soldiers that ended up being paid in the deserts of North Africa and the fields of Russia.
Yep, and
so that we could learn to fight a better blitzkrieg.
Right. Don't you think, too, though, that part of that has to do with the differential in the way that those nations, where they place the value in the state first, then in the citizen, because they're not citizens, they're subjects, basically. And as a result, their layer, that I think is our best and our worst thing. I always say that we sow the seeds of our own demise based upon our desire to consider that each and every individual human life is the most important, which is what makes us such a great nation, but also, unfortunately, makes us weak to those who do not play by that same playbook. And therefore, when they have such a weapon within their ability, then they are not able, they are able to do things that we would never be able to do because we're hamstrung with both the political problem and the fear of retribution by the own people after you succeed at letting them live long enough to get there. And that's always the problem. It's very complex. I mean, you did a really fantastic job in The Long Sunday, chronicling, for instance, how we, which is something that makes me crazy, that we have basically reduced ourselves to 180-gauge gravity bombs stored in European NATO, while Russia has built 3,000, 8,000 tactical nukes for use in the battlefield. And North Korea, while we gave them billions of dollars to play nice, they continued on to make new weapons while we have done nothing. We've basically circumscribed ourselves to the power of others instead of standing, and I've played it so many times my listeners I'm sure grumble, but I have the YouTube video up of Ronald Reagan with Gorbachev when he says trust through verification, and that's really the key. But you can never expect diplomacy in and of itself, or as you so perfectly point out, any political policy or sanctions, monetary sanctions, to stop misactors by acting how they're going to act anyway. It's not going to work. There's only one thing that does that, and that's the threat of unbelievably a superior force that they know at any moment can be unleashed on them.
I agree completely. And to build upon your point, going back to the experience of the Romans again, which I think here is relevant to us, the thing that made Rome great in the beginning, which raised it up from a little city on the Tiber to becoming a world empire, the empire of the known world at that time, when Rome was at its most successful, you know, it was governed as a republic that was dominated by its small farmers and by the, in effect, it wouldn't be accurate to call them a middle class, but they were the working guys of Rome who ran small farms and also manned the army on a volunteer basis when an army was needed. And these guys, of course, I mean, they had to pay the taxes. They had to put their lives on the line. And they were very practical men because nobody took care of them. They took care of themselves and they took care of their families. Being a farmer is a very hard and practical business. Your survival on a day-to-day basis depends on you making the right decisions about when to plant crops, what to plant, what the weather's going to be like, what are my contingency plans. Every farmer basically has to think like a general for his family. And Rome got in trouble, and what began its decline and fall is when it transitioned from being a republic into being an imperial system, where the farmers, basically, they were all recruited into the army, and we're no longer farmers anymore. They became permanent soldiers, and the wealthy aristocrats took over the farmlands and had them farmed by slaves. So there wasn't this great body of independent, free-thinking people anymore. You had masses who were living on bread and circuses, you know, in Rome, who were entertained and fed and and kept in line by the Roman aristocracy, the elites that ran Rome. And you can really see, you know, the series of bad decisions that happens when power comes into out of the hands of a practical, pragmatic-minded, free and independent-minded people, and gets into the hands of a wealthy aristocracy, which is really divorced from the practical exigencies of living life, because they have so much wealth that they are insulated from it, and they don't have to live with the consequences of their own decisions. Other people die for their bad decisions.
Absolutely.
Doesn't that sound so much like where we are today? You know, in just my father's generation, if we use the example of World War II, going back, you know, people think that Franklin Roosevelt and General Patton won World War II. Now, they were good leaders, and they made a contribution to World War II. But the people who really won World War II were people like my father, Frank Pry, my Uncle Joe, you know, the guys that I was talking about before that spent their lives in blood in the battlefields of Europe and North Africa and, yeah, on the plains of Russia to learn how to fight a better blitzkrieg. They're the ones who had to compensate for the bad decisions made by elites over the years not to come up with the blitzkrieg. So they had to go into battle against Tiger tanks, superior armor, you know, almost all the weapons and tactics that the Germans had were better than what our guys had, you know, which is why our people ended up dying in disproportionate numbers, you know, compared to the casualties the Germans often took. You know, I mean, our Sherman tanks were just iron coffins, you know, when they had to go up against Tigers and Panthers. And our people learned, they knew they had won World War II. My father knew that him and his GI buddies, they had won World War II. And they didn't have a lot of respect for the U.S. government telling them what to do and how to live their lives. They had seen government fail in peace during the Great Depression, and they had had to rescue that government in war by putting their lives on the line in World War II, which isn't to say they weren't patriotic. They were patriotic, but their patriotism wasn't mainly for the federal government.
Right.
For the whole people of America, and for the Constitution, and for the civilization that we are, that was bequeathed to us by the Founding Fathers. That's where their patriotism and loyalty was.
Right,
but
and
not
that,
the IRS and the various departments and agencies of the federal government.
And the thing is, if I may, that's the one thing is that what you're talking about is that old saying that comes from those people who were mostly farmers and people who were working in the mines and whatnot, who came from hard work, who knew how to take difficult times and turn them into something. And they always would say, I had a friend who was in World War I. He was one of my teachers in elementary school. And he said to me, I love my nation. I don't love my government. That's the way they looked at it. And that was his take, too. I mean, clearly, that's what you're talking about. And
yeah, exactly. And they were, and this has always been, up until recently, this has always been the attitude of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Founders didn't trust government.
That's for sure.
That's why they built our government, so that there are checks and balances in it. And they wrote a constitution and a bill of rights to constrain the government, not to constrain the people. They always felt that the government itself was the greatest threat to the liberty of the people, and they thought so correctly because they looked back at the history of Greece and Rome and how few democracies constitutional republics existed and how often brief their lives were and the mechanics of what led to their fall.
Mm-hmm.
And they were particularly interested in the history of Rome.
Right. Well, they also Athenian Republic, they studied very heavily. I've read a lot of detailed papers written by people like Jefferson and all kinds of people who were through the group of what we know as the Founding Fathers. And it's quite interesting how interested they were in those two specific republics in particular, and how they failed.
You can see this interest and even love affair with Roman history among the fathers in the architecture, the early so-called Federalist architecture, you know, houses that supported columns.
Right.
It always interests me the names of so many of our cities. For example, I grew up near Utica, New York. You know, what is Utica? You know, what is that? Most people who live in Utica have no idea what Utica is. Why would you name a city Utica?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Utica was the city in North Africa where Cato committed suicide, you know, rather than submit to the tyranny of Julius Caesar. At least that's how the pro-Catoite, pro-Roman Republic faction interprets it, Cato's act.
And
he's a hero to them. We even have a Cato Institute still operating in Washington that's an enemy and fearful big government. But, you know, there's so many names of our cities that are taken from Roman and Greece and classical history. And that's why most of them were named in the 19th century by a people who studied history all until
real
history. Recent times, classical, you couldn't be educated unless you were well-grounded in classical history, because that's where we came mm-hmm. from. That's where our civilization came from, and that's where the current government, we unfortunately, in the course of one or two generations, not only don't study that history, but I'm afraid we've been transforming. The character of our people has been transforming from the kind of character the founders intended our republic to be for, you know, a people who are proud of their independence, jealous of their freedom, don't trust the government.
Mm-hmm.
They want to do for themselves. They realize that if they take handouts for the government and trust the government, that risks their freedom. That's the kind of people we were all the way up to my father's generation.
Yeah.
The great generation that won World War II and lived through the Great Depression. Now, so quickly, we've been transformed. The attitudes are very European and less American, you know, where we, as you had noted before, you know, the European classes, one of the reasons the Europeans went down so quickly was because they were a class system, and they trusted those elites who were insulated from the vicissitudes of life and believed that, oh, Hitler couldn't possibly mean what he's talking about starting a war. No rational man. The Nazis must really think the way we do. And, you know, who would want to go to war and risk this very comfortable existence that we elites enjoy? I mean, that attitude is what almost lost Western democracy.
Yes.
William F. Buckley once said he'd rather be ruled by the first 100 names in the New York City phone book than by, you know, the political leaders that we have permanently ensconced in Washington.
For sure.
At least in my father's generation, that would have been true. I'm not sure it's true anymore, because unfortunately the corrupted attitudes of the elites have affected so many of our young people and so many of the people who are not elite.
I agree. You know, two points that I wanted to touch on with you that are on my list is, in a minute, I'd like to jump into the idea of non-contact warfare. But first, I wanted to touch on something. You touched on the oligarchy and how it plays into this, because I do think that while we're talking about the threat of EMP and other types of threats to the power system of the United States and, in turn, our way of life as we know it. But it's important, like you said, to understand what makes this happen. And when you look, and I've talked about this, I did physical hands-on security design and development consulting during periods of time where, for instance, in northern New Jersey near New York, there was an incident that was very similar to the Metcalf incident, but it was in smaller size. They used a .22 rifle from long distance and took out two power transformers. There was another incident in 2004 in really southern New Jersey near Philadelphia, where they threw large chains, truck tow chains, on top of the power transformers on a very key substation that took down 10,000 people's power for 4 days in the heat of the summer. And they were directly linked back to a group who operates in this country that's known as ELF, their Earth Liberation Front. And their mission statement, which if you can find it, because they put it up and it gets taken down all the time, their thing is about telling people to work independently so they can't cut the Hydra's head off and go and attack, because over a period of time, there was the incident in Pacific Northwest where the guy who was basically poo-pooed as a loony, who was wearing an ELF T-shirt went around unbolting large power towers across the Pacific Northwest so that in the wind they would fall over and they blacked out LA. These are big things because they are warning signs to a much bigger problem. And, you know, when they take out, like in Metcalf was a great example, where they take out a transformer, it used to be 6 months. As a matter of fact, only about 30 minutes from where I am now, I used to secure the facility where GE used to make their 13.8 kilovolt transformers. They took them out. Now they are making them, I'm told, in Romania. It takes 1 year to get them ordered and put together and 3 to 6 months to bring them here. So during Sandy, as I get it from some people that I know who work for the utilities, they lost about 16 transformers during Sandy, and even now they still have not replaced them all. It's taken that long. So,
yes, you're right. You know, these signs, the attack on Metcalf, the recent cyber attack against 150 nations, even if this was not perpetrated by, like, the North Koreans, the Russians, or the Chinese, although at least many analysts are saying that the North Koreans might have been involved in this cyber holdup of the world community, I think it's analogous to where we were well, let's talk about no-contact war first. You know, this new way of warfare. No-contact war is the title of a book by General Vladimir Slepchenko, a person who I happened to meet when I was on the EMP Commission back in 2004. And he is one of the most forward-thinking. He's sort of the Rommel of the cybersecurity age. He came up with this new revolution in military affairs called No Contact War in his book, where he describes this greatest revolution in military affairs that has ever happened in history, in human history, according to Slepchenko, and I think he's right. You know, where we have a technological opportunity has arisen from using cyber attacks to go against electric grids. The key to it all is attacking the electric grid instead of attacking military forces. That's why he calls it no-contact war. Envisions fighting and winning a war without coming in contact with the enemy's military forces by going after the Achilles heel of every advanced society, which is the electric grid. And that a grid would be attacked by cyber, by physical sabotage, by non-nuclear radio frequency weapons using non-nuclear EMP, and ultimately by nuclear EMP attack. You only need one nuke detonated at high altitude, above 30 kilometers, up to 400 kilometers high, so high it's in outer space, basically, so high that above the atmosphere, so you wouldn't even hear the explosion. There'd be no fallout, blast, or other thermal effects that we associate with a nuclear weapon. Only the EMP would be experienced on the ground. So you wouldn't even know a nuclear attack had happened at all. You might just think that the lights have gone out from a normal blackout until you go to start your car. And then you find that none of the electronics, or very few of them, actually work because the EMP has shorted them all out. And the most damaging thing it does is it would black out the electric grid, not just for a short time, but potentially for months or years or permanently. And right. I say permanently because the Congressional EMP Commission estimates that if we have a blackout that lasts 1 year, we can lose 90% of our population.
Right.
Starvation, disease, and societal collapse. And so that means if you've got a blackout the last 1 year, you're not coming back from it. That's the end of your civilization if you can't recover before your people starve to death.
Right, and
we've only got enough food to feed 320 million Americans for 30 days.
Right.
Normal consumption rates. And it begins to spoil 3 days after the lights go out in the EMP attack. That's the problem. And that's Slepchenko's concept of a no-contact war. Now, his main object is not necessarily, although it could be, to kill off, to do mass destruction of populations by starvation. Slepchenko's original concept is, as I wrote in a recent article, that the Russians call it de-escalation, the strategy of de-escalation. You know, by doing an EMP attack, early on in a war, one of the first things you do, that it will in effect have shock and awe on your adversaries.
Right, demoralization.
American leaders have been so educated or brainwashed over the decades to fear nuclear wars, the thing we fear most, and therefore we want to avoid escalation. So we will de-escalate the conflict by suing for peace.
Yeah.
And because the EMP has knocked out our critical infrastructures, we know that the very survival of our society is at stake. And so we want to get out of the war and go about recovering our society in a hurry, and maybe even get any help from the bad guys that knocked the lights out in the first place, so that we don't lose our people.
Right.
And that's his theory of using EMP. So it's not mainly intended to kill off your rival nations. It's intended to get them to surrender so that they then become your subjects.
Correct.
However,
and
the North Korean and Iranian spin on Slepchenko's idea, and the Iranians actually pay tribute to Slepchenko in their book on military doctrine on this subject. They pay tribute to him on page one of their book. Their idea is to use the EMP to kill everybody off who is an infidel.
Right.
Now, because their geopolitical different objectives are not of this earth. And similarly with the North Koreans, they have a similarly homicidal goal, but for different reasons than the Iranians. But that's the new way of war that would use cyber and sabotage and EMP attack in combination. It's sort of like a blitzkrieg.
Right.
Against the critical infrastructures
and
avoids.
And of course.
Sorry, go on. No,
I'm sorry. Of course, what you're talking about is what the War College has talked about for years. And those in their version, when I was in Russia, many of my contacts there, they would always speak about softening the target. So basically, that's what you're talking about. The de-escalation would be the act of basically demoralizing the people. And because we already, as you so perfectly pointed out, we have lost our ability to perceive that every single threat is able to be overcome if there's a consensus and an act as a team, as the old saying went, you know, divided we fall, together we stand. That's the deal. We aren't together anymore in a large part. And so as a result, they are afraid. They want safe rooms and puppies to pet. And instead, we are up against people who deal with not even having food necessarily every day, who would be the ones who would be essentially affixing this upon us. They're not going to feel bad for them. That's what's going to happen. So this is the call to action, which is why I wanted to get you on, especially with what's going on right now. And I once again really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're kind of ground down and you've been on it for several weeks, but I think this is such an important point. And things like the cyber attack linked with super EMP weapons, we are seeing, and we haven't even touched on yet, one of my pet peeves that I've talked into oblivion about, the two Korean satellites that are in not geosynchronous orbit, but are in polar orbit. And
yes,
you know, these are things that are really a big deal. And if you have a couple minutes to enlighten them a little more than what I've already done, that would be really awesome.
Certainly. About the satellites?
Yes.
Yes. That's a real... I can't think of a more clear and present sign of a possible imminent EMP attack than those satellites. During the Cold War, well, let me make the story go back a little bit. Go back to the year 2004. In that year, something surprising and unprecedented happened. And the Congressional EMP Commission was demarched by two Russian generals, their top EMP experts, who wanted to tell us a story. So we got together with them, and they told us that, you know, Russia had developed, you know, super EMP weapons. These are nuclear weapons of special design. They're not designed to make a big explosion. They're designed to create gamma rays, which is what causes the EMP effect. And because they're not designed to make a big explosion, but to put out gamma rays, they're very small. They can be less than 100 pounds. They're like a neutron artillery shell. the W-79 Neutron Artillery Shell. I've held one of those in my hands. They're less than 100 pounds. If you tweak that design, which is a 50-year-old design, you know, you can turn that into what's called, what the Russians call, a super EMP warhead that produces these extraordinarily powerful EMP fields, and it's easy to make it. So we knew the Russians already had the super. They've been writing about it, and, you know, we know from other sources as well that they've got it. But they told us that the design for their super had accidentally leaked to North Korea back in 2004. And that, moreover, supposedly through no fault of their own, Russian scientists, and they said Chinese scientists and scientists from Pakistan, too, were being very well paid by North Korea to work in the North Korean nuclear and missile programs. And they wanted to warn us about this because they said that in a couple of years, since it's not hard to build the super EMP weapon, they expected North Korea might be able to test one of these things. And sure enough, a couple of years later, in 2006, North Korea did its first nuclear test, which was widely laughed at by the international community as a failure because it was very low yield. It was only 1 to 3 kilotons. And yet, that's exactly what a super EMP weapon would look like, that yield profile. And whatever the device was, the North Koreans were happy with it because they immediately started weaponizing it and putting them on Nodong missiles. And the next several tests that they conducted were similarly low yield, under 10 kilotons, looking like that. So, you know, this evidence is compelling. The North Koreans have got the super. Independently of the EMP Commission, the South Korean intelligence and a Chinese military observer also said the North Koreans had the super. Now, there's another Russian secret weapon, in addition to the super, that the Russians didn't talk about to us, but we knew it existed, and it's called a fractional orbital bombardment system that they came up with in the Cold War. And what this is, you use a long-range missile, a satellite, supposedly a space launch vehicle for peaceful purposes, all right? And you put a nuclear weapon inside a satellite so that it's disguised, this peaceful space launch vehicle. And then you launch it away from the south, away from the United States, to the south, so that the trajectory of the missile doesn't look threatening to us for two reasons. First, it's flying away from us, and second, it's on a satellite trajectory, not on the arcing ballistic trajectory that you use for an ICBM for getting accuracy. You know, when our people see our ballistic missile early warning radars and the like, they see that trajectory, they have all these reasons to not fear it and think, oh, it's just a satellite being launched. Well, the satellite goes on a southward trajectory, passes over the South Pole, over Antarctica, and comes up on the other side. So it approaches the United States from the south, where we have no ballistic missile early warning radars and no national missile defenses. So we're blind and defenseless from the south. We always have been through the Cold War. We never defended that area. When it gets over the center of the United States at the satellite altitude, you detonate it, and it puts out an EMP that would then paralyze our command and control, our strategic forces, and of course collapse our unprotected civilian grid. The Russian idea for doing this secret weapon was they would do an EMP first strike to paralyze us and then launch their ICBMs and submarine missiles to go to our bomber bases and silos and do a disarming first strike to complete the job and basically win a nuclear war. The North Koreans are doing the same thing, except they don't have the numbers or the accuracy of missiles to do a disarming strike. They do have the ability to just kill our population, and that seems to be the object of these tests. The Iranians are practicing, by the way. They've launched several satellites on south polar trajectories, too. Now, fortunately, none of those are in permanent orbit over the United States, but the two South North Korean satellites are in a long-term orbit. They're going to be passing over us for years. The KSM-3 was launched in 2012, December 2012, and it's still up there, passing over us every 90 minutes or so. Yeah, and then the KMS-3, they launched on February 7th. So it's orbiting over us, too, every 90 minutes or so. And what it looks to me like, they're trying to build a constellation of these things so that now they've got two satellites up there, so that every 45 minutes, we're going to have one of those satellites. You know, if they launch a third, it reduces the time, you know, so that, in effect, what they're trying to do is, I think, is back in the 19th century, we had battleship diplomacy. You know, when you wanted to intimidate and get somebody to back down and accede to your demands, you'd send a battleship off their shores, and usually that cave without you even having to fire a gun. I think the North Koreans, the most benign interpretation of this is the North Koreans are just practicing, and there are no nuclear weapons on those satellites, but they're practicing for a nuclear EMP attack. A more cynical interpretation is the satellites may well be nuclear armed. We don't know if they are or not. But if they have nuclear arms, they could do the modern EMP cyber world version of battleship diplomacy. So if the president plans on attacking North Korea, or if they get tired of the sanctions, you know, they can tap the president on the shoulder and say, "Sir, every 45 minutes we've got a satellite that could destroy your country going overhead. Do you really want to try to intimidate us any further? We're prepared to light it off and destroy your civilization."
Right, and
so that's,
aren't they're in violation of, I mean, not that it's worth spit in the wind, but they're in violation of international law with those satellites as they are, aren't they?
Yes, that's correct. Their whole missile and space program and their military program, all of it, those satellites are illegal. They're not supposed to be up there at all. Hmm. And it's a sign, I think, of the risk of probably losing many of your people because I'm so critical of our modern elites, okay?
I doubt it.
I think it's a sign of the degeneracy of our elites, you know, that we tolerate that.
Yeah.
I mean, just think of how the great generation reacted before we even knew about EMP, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When the Soviet Union orbited a satellite over the United States and they also had nuclear weapons, everybody came together. Eisenhower and LBJ, they came together. LBJ was the majority leader in the Senate at the time that happened, and Eisenhower was the president, and they both said, you know, we're in trouble. They can take, if they can launch a satellite, they can throw a nuclear weapon onto the United States. And we started building, that's when we launched our own ICBM program, because we all knew it was coming. We knew it was coming. And it was a good thing we did, because by the time the Cuban Missile Crisis came along, we had a 5-to-1 superiority in ICBMs, and that's why Khrushchev backed down.
Right.
5-to-1 superiority in ICBMs. Today, we won't even tell our people that they've got North Korean satellites orbiting over the United States. And nobody wants to even think about what that implies when it's just so obvious, you know, what the North Koreans are up to in that. They are trying to put us in a position where they can surprise us with a nuclear EMP attack when they're ready to do it. And our own elites and our in conjunction with our mass media, you know, are either through stupidity or bad judgment or because they don't want to make people afraid, you know, are
Well, I'll tell you, I've been in over 100 countries as an investigator. I've interrogated a lot of bad people who've done a lot of really bad things. And one thing I am convinced of is this, what you just described, and most all of my listeners, I'm sure, completely concur, is not a matter of stupidity or ignorance or being concerned about being afraid of upsetting people. It's because they have such an utter utter contempt for what our nation was created to be. We have a lot of social Marxists. I declare myself openly as a classical liberal, not a social liberal. The people who created this nation, as you so perfectly put it, they had great disdain for the oligarchy, the elitists, and government as it was prior to our nation. And they clearly understood the clear and present danger that came from refusing to act, and that either having action paralysis because of their ideologies or complete disconnect from reality that, as I always say, I'm writing a book right now, I'm 238 pages in. As I always say, human are three things. You ignore those things at your own risk. They are lazy, greedy, and violent. And the only way we get past that is through communication and education. And clearly we're failing in those areas. So we are now in a place where we are at the brink. and it's really sad. And that's why I really appreciate you coming on to enlighten the listeners, because I don't like them only hearing from me. I like to hear them to hear from people who have real serious chops out there, where you have had influence in government, and yet you're still seeing the same exact thing that I tell them all the time.
Well, keep telling them that same thing all the time. I salute you, and I'm grateful that you are being part of the solution, you know, by having programs like this, by trying to educate people about the problem. I mean, you're trying to do what Churchill did before World War II. Churchill and his little band of followers who were trying to warn people about the Nazi menace.
Well, Neville Chamberlain. Neville Chamberlain ran him over. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really sad, and I'm honored and humbled by your comments, because I see you as that. I think you are one of the great warriors out there using intellect to help to steer people, hopefully while there's still some time, to do something to correct it. Before we run out of time, there was one other thing if you could make a mention for, because this is another one of my pet issues, and that's in Cyrillic air base in Turkey.
Yes.
And, you know, when they laid up after that coup and laid up anti-aircraft guns and told us, you take off, we shoot you down, we want access to your nukes, I see that as way bigger than anything that the Cuban Missile Crisis ever was.
Yes, and yeah, how few people, and I can see you are a close reader of my literature. I was one of the few who wrote an article about that, you know, how dangerous that situation was. Because here you have the Erdogan government, which is basically an Islamist government. He's definitely taking Turkey out of the West and in the direction of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And and this was predicted, by the way, by Samuel Huntington in his book on the clash of civilizations and the remaking of world order, a book written 20 years ago. But the man got it. It's one of the few smart people at Harvard, Paul Hunting, you know. And he got it spot on. He predicted in that book that because Turkey, you know, was a part of Islam, that they were going to go back to their civilizational roots and start deorbiting out of the West and trying to become a leader of the Islamic civilization against us. And Erdogan is definitely, I mean, Turkey has gone from, you know, a sterling example of a democracy in the Middle East. And it wasn't an example of an Islamic democracy. It had been a secular democracy. And their military, you know, was dominated by secular people who kept the Islamists down because they knew the Islamists were a threat to the democratic institutions and values that they were trying to use to modernize Turkey. But Erdogan has reversed all that.
Yeah, in a stunning speed.
And here we are. We have more than half of what's left of our sparse tactical nuclear arsenal located in Incirlik Air Force Base in the middle of Turkey, on an air base that we share with the Turks.
Mm-hmm.
It would be so easy for them, you know, to basically become a nuclear weapon state overnight just by seizing our own nuclear weapons.
Right.
I really thought, and I still think, we should get those weapons out of there.
Well, according to
them in Germany.
Actually, according to Stratfor and some of the other sources that I use, they say that we've moved most of them successfully already into Romania and lit up an $800 million base that we had built there, and that Russia's having a conniption over it right now.
Oh, good. I hope that's true,
right.
Because that would be... that would be a wise thing to do.
You better believe it.
Things in Turkey would be a serious strategic mistake.
No question. And as you said, in a blink of an eye, here's a man who has reversed from 1924 in the Constitution placed in creating a secular nation that made them basically... unlike with, say, Iraq, where they jammed together all these disparate nations without making a thing, this happened, and this happened from in the remnants of the Ottoman Empire. And you would think the people in Europe who were under the thumb for 450 years of the Ottoman Empire and its oppression would be losing their minds to do something about it, and they're dead silent because they're oblivious to what happens. It's shocking. It's really shocking.
Yeah. I also think Turkey is a really good object lesson, you know, from a historian's perspective, in the futility of trying to remake other cultures into Western-style democracies who do not have their historical roots. Ataturk basically tried to impose Western-style democracy on Turkey.
Right.
It was a top-down thing, but the culture was never transformed.
Yeah.
The culture was always Islamist, and you can almost, and you can see that trajectory. I mean, Turkey, you know, you remember Paul's epistles to the Corinthians and all that?
Right.
I mean, Turkey used to be a Christian nation.
Yep.
And now Christians are a diminished minority.
Yeah.
They continue to have always been persecuted, so the culture never changed. And it's just an object lesson in how the history and culture is far more important than the institutional, than the elites' visions for their people if the culture remains unchanged.
And
that's why it's been so easy. It's not because Erdogan is some kind of a genius. It's because Turkey's natural cultural civilizational roots are not in democracy.
Right.
They're in a totalitarian or authoritarian Islamist state, and it's taken a blink of an eye to turn them back.
Right, and I have to, well, unfortunately, we're out of time, so I'm going to beg you to come back on with us at some point in the near future to continue this conversation. But
I would welcome that opportunity. It's always a pleasure to be interviewed by someone so well-informed.
Thank you very much, and I will close this by saying, as you've all heard me say over and over ad nauseum for years now, is that it is not about the color of the skin or any of the racial issues that you hear in the blather that is pumped out in the media here. It is about culture. And culture drives action and drives all of these situations that we deal with that either make our world great or make it a threat. And that's the fact. So until next week, I really thank you so much. We've been had the pleasure of having Dr. Peter Pry on with us, and we will invite you back again, and I'll give you a call after we hang up and just to close out with you. Thank you so much. And for everyone who's been listening, this has been a great honor to have you on with us, and I really appreciate it. Until next week, I am Will Hemingway. This is Practice Preparedness. Remember, there is no disaster when you are prepared. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Be prepared. Have a good day and be safe.
And that, unfortunately, will be it for this edition of the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. I am your host, Will Hemingway. Thank you for spending your time with us today. Don't forget to click the links at the top of practicepreparedness.com, to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and meetup.com. Until next time, please don't wait until it's too late. Live proactively. Act with purpose every day. Have a plan and practice. Because, as I always say, there is no disaster when you are prepared. We hope that you'll join us next time for the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. Have a good day.